Monster Man, Episode 391, Elementals Revisited, Part 3. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. For the last two episodes, we have been in the Elementals section, and that's not gonna change. In fact, we are looking at one monster that I know we've seen before, but that's been greatly expanded, and one that I'm not so sure about. These kinds of monsters kind of tend to run together for me sometimes. Perhaps literally in this case. Also, in the last regular episode, I mentioned an upcoming talk as part of a digital launch for the book that I co-wrote, Lion Rampant, A Viking in the Sun. I now have a link for that I will put in the show notes. So, like I said, I'm going to show my fallibility in this episode because I actually am not sure if we've done this handling as I record this, and I'm too lazy to go downstairs and look. I don't think so. We have definitely done the Pech. So the Earthkin, like the Airkin that we talked about previously, are a pair of kind of quasi-elemental beings. At any rate, they are not the familiar Earth elementals. Let's start with the Pech. So the Pech are hard-working minor types who originated on the elemental plane of Earth, and they have great power over stone, which they use to, you know, do their jobs of being miners, and also to defend their communities against intruders. They have a special rule that they always do maximum damage against Earth creatures, you know, your rock monsters and Earth elementals, whatever, even if they're using non-magical weapons, because their powers of Earth manipulation and their knowledge of Earth are so great that they always know exactly where to hit. So as I was reading the Pech entry, I thought to myself, how do these clearly humanoid creatures live on the elemental plane of Earth? That seems like a very harsh environment. And the answer is that it is tough. In fact, it's so tough that they essentially came to the prime material plane looking for work. You know, because they're such great miners, they can make a living on another plane and not have to put up with the harsh conditions of their home plane. You know, the Pech are creatures from Scottish folklore, I think. And, you know, I wonder if this is some kind of nod to the idea of, you know, the British Empire being full of Scottish people who, you know, left behind hard times in their native land to go seek their fortune in Canada or wherever. Being miners makes them sound Cornish, right? Like, times are tough in Cornwall, so, you know, you wind up in Michigan. I liked these little guys the first time that we did them, and I continue to like them now. They're characterful, they're different enough from the usual run of fey creatures that I think they work pretty well. And they could be very useful allies, but they have, you know, particular idiosyncrasies, particular needs that would mean you'd have to handle them rather carefully, which is something that I like in potential allies. Next up, we have the Sandling. Sandlings are kind of shape-shifting blobs of sand, like animal versions of Sandman from Spider-Man. And like Sandman from Spider-Man, you can mess them up by diluting them with water, which sort of turns them into mud, which is not what happens when you put a lot of water in sand, but never mind. And it slows them down. There is a little section on their ecology and their reproductive cycle, as we have come to see, but I wish it had been devoted to building in a little more interesting stuff for sandlings to do in scenarios. As it stands, a sandling is essentially a rattlesnake. So it lies on the ground, and because it's made of sand, it's basically impossible to spot it. And when an unwary adventurer steps too close to the sandling, then the sandling feels threatened and takes a swipe at him. They don't seek out trouble, they have no agenda, they don't eat people or anything. So they're not otherwise a particular threat. They're just there to kind of be in the way. And on that level, they work okay, but they work in a very, like, narrowly specific context. If you're in some kind of temple of the Earth Goddess, or indeed if you're venturing onto the elemental plane of Earth, then absolutely the sandling feels like it would be, you know, a hazard that kind of makes sense. But other than that, I don't really know the situation in which they would come up. They just feel like a high magic gloss on a rattlesnake. And that's fine. It's not wrong that there are monsters that have those kind of believably animal-like motivations, where they're not out to commit evil or anything like that. They just don't like it when you get too close. And you can definitely add a few to an existing scenario to give a particular part of your dungeon a little extra hazard. Like I said before about a number of different monsters back in the original Monster Manual, and indeed in the Fiendfolio, there are monsters where it's a perfectly valid function for them just to complicate things. This room full of sandlings is fine. You can cross it as long as you don't step too close to them, and if you really pay attention, you can see where they are. You have to imagine that detecting a sandling on a cave floor would be particularly difficult by the light of a flickering torch. And if someone has infravision, I imagine they're kind of room temperature, so that wouldn't help either. But so, you know, if you're cautious, you can pick your way through the room where the sandlings are on the floor. But then when you're like fleeing at top speed from the gnolls through this room, then it'll be good if you can avoid the sandlings because maybe they'll attack the gnolls, but it'll be just an additional problem if you can't. I get that. But I had to do all of that analysis while this book told me a bunch of stuff that could not possibly be relevant about sandling reproductive cycles. I'm not going to get a job breeding sandlings. I almost said, what is the use case here? And I actually think that one of the problems that Monster's Manual has compared to some of the other books is that comparatively little thought has been given to that use case, or perhaps a lot of thought and just a different conclusion reached. As I said before, Monster's Manual sometimes treats itself like it is an encyclopedia about a fantasy world rather than a book used in running a game. And I'm not saying that every D&D game has to have combat. Don't get me wrong, I love all those other aspects of fantasy adventure, and I am much more willing to tolerate the fact that the sandling is basically a landmine and no more when it's only half a page long instead of a full page. So there is that. And in the Sandling's final defense, I should say that it's got a great Tony DiTerlizzi illustration together with its friend the Peck. So, on balance, it's not that I don't like this creature. I just think that either you could do the same thing in less space, or you could give it a little bit of extra something, you know? Zhuzh it up a little bit. And I do think that this era of D&D suffers a little bit from that unwillingness to zhuzh things up a little bit, from that unwillingness to put in maybe like some optional stuff that the creature could be like, because again, that will kind of weaken its perceived position of authority. You know, if you are saying there are lots of different ways to have a sandling in your game, then you're no longer the official, the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons trademark game that it was trying to be. But perhaps my harshness toward the sandling is a little bit based on how much I enjoyed the Peck, where the specific thing of them being like economic migrants is really enjoyable. It does kind of bring the planar cosmology into the realm of the mundane, but I think it's a good bit. All right, that's about all the Elementalkin that we have time for today. In the middle of this week, Patreon subscribers at the $2 and higher level are going to get a new episode of Patron Deities as we continue our journey through the Indian Mythos section, and then another episode of Monster Man for everyone to close out the week. And I hope that you'll all join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.